From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll speak with the authors of Choosing Love to explore how people can identify as both conservative Christians and LGBTQ+. Then we'll meet Milwaukee Recreation's director.
My goal and our goal of our department is to have healthy neighborhoods one at a time. A healthy Milwaukee is a healthy environment for all of us, for our schools, for our county. I just wanted to be a part of that so bad.
Plus, we'll learn how pull tabs ended up in so many Wisconsin bars.
It's a very satisfying feeling of pulling those strips, kind of unzip them, and you see if you won a prize.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Religion offers people of faith many things, including support and a sense of community. But for LGBTQ+ people, their relationship with religion, specifically Christianity, can be difficult. Trying to live authentically in a system that may explicitly deny who they are can present challenges. This piqued the interest of a couple Marquette University professors who researched what happens when two identities that seem in total opposition are joined together. Dawn Moon and Teresa Tobin explore how LGBTQ+ Christians and their allies are working to make their families, churches, and communities more inclusive in their book, Choosing Love. To talk about the book and the people who helped shape it, Moon and Tobin join Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski.
You both worked on this book, Choosing Love. So can you start us off by introducing yourselves and sharing how you both came together to start this unique research back in 2014?
So I'm a sociologist who has been studying religion and gender and sexuality since the 1990s. And I started this project when I first heard about the movement among evangelical LGBTQ+ people when my partner's cousin, who was evangelical, came out, and other people in his immediate family were trying to figure out how they should respond and approached me and asked like what I thought was the proper Christian response to homosexuality, which I thought was an odd thing for him to be asking me at the time since I'm not religious, but he knew that I studied it. And we started swapping articles. And from him, I learned that these organizations had started up and that this movement was happening. And it just seemed like everything that I had been studying in my life up to that point had like come together. Because in addition to being interested in how U.S. Protestants were navigating questions around gender and sexuality, I had also been taking some time studying dialogue, and particularly the Jewish-Palestinian dialogue movement. And so here was dialogue happening among conservative Protestants talking about sexuality and gender. And I just, you know, I was like, I have to figure out what's going on here. I was really curious and really fascinated. And then I had the opportunity to apply for a grant from the Templeton Religion Trust that required me to work with someone in the humanities. And I remembered that Teresa had done research on spiritual violence and seemed like a good partner for the project.
Yeah. So, Teresa, can you share a bit more about your background and the lens that you brought to this?
Yeah, definitely. So I'm a moral philosopher. I work primarily in contemporary ethics and social philosophy from a feminist perspective. And I've always been interested in ethical questions that arise at the intersection of people's faith experiences and spirituality and gender and sexuality. And both from a, you know, philosophical perspective, but also a personal perspective. I'm Roman Catholic, and I grew up with a background and lots of questions around that intersection. And in 2010, I started to read testimony from survivors of the clergy sexual abuse crisis. And a lot of them were naming spiritual violence as a harm of that form of abuse that was not getting a lot of attention. So the idea of spiritual violence when your religion and your religious upbringing and authorities and rituals and practices are actually used to harm people spiritually and to erect barriers to their relationship with God. And I was so impacted by that term. And I just thought, I want to study that more. But then also seeing connections between what women and LGBTQ plus folks in Christian communities and Catholic communities in particular were also naming as kind of spiritual harm. So when Dawn approached me, I saw these connections and I was like, oh, I'm doing this thing by myself. But when Dawn approached me with this grant opportunity that, you know, gave birth to a whole new research project and trajectory.
Right. And this research is based on interviews that you've conducted with people in the Midwest, across the nation, who are part of groups that are trying to figure out this intersectionality. So I want to lay out some basic definitions for the listeners related to our conversation and this book. And let's start with the phrase welcoming but not affirming. Can you explain what this means in regard to Christian communities?
Yeah, I can try. So in some Christian spaces, people will say that they are welcoming of LGBTQ plus people, meaning those people are permitted to come to celebrate in the liturgy, to sometimes maybe even participate in ministry, lead the music ministry, be part of the community in that sense. But not affirming then means that the official position of the church is that we don't acknowledge or accept or affirm or celebrate that you are gay or lesbian or transgender. So we're not affirming or accepting your sexuality or your gender identity as something to acknowledge, recognize, and celebrate. But we, you know, we're still saying that's sinful, but you're welcome to be here. We're all sinners. We're all on a journey, and you're welcome to be here and be part of our community. So that's how I've understood that.
Yeah, and this kind of touches upon the whole idea of conditional love that you explore. And as you were saying before, Dawn, these groups are helping people try to understand, like, how do I fit into this place, right? So with this book and the lens that you viewed it in, how do you both define or characterize conservative LGBTQ Christians? Because from an outside perspective, if someone's not practicing or not familiar, a lot of people could assume that this is a bit of an oxymoron, right?
Yeah, I would say that they're conservative Christians in that they use conservative Christian techniques of interpreting the Bible. They tend to be part of conservative Christian culture. Conservative Christian music is the music that speaks to them. They may have, you know, some conservative Christian denominations or independent churches basically teach people ways to channel the Holy Spirit or to have their own conversations with God. And that's formed them. That's who they are. And they're gay, bi, trans, queer. And so a lot of times, and we have encountered this even among other academics, where we say we're talking about the LGBTQ conservative Christian movement, and people are just like, well, that's not, that can't exist. The only thing that defines whether you're conservative or not is your stance on gender and sexuality in that case. But that basically is not the foundation of their Christianity. The foundation of their Christianity is their relationship with Jesus. And so the idea that your ideas or your understanding of gender and sexuality would erase all of that seems to give a lot of power to gender and sexuality, right? A lot of power to these social constructions as opposed to people's relationship with the divine.
To kind of navigate this big water, right, of this area of study, the people you're talking to, you do focus on the significance of four emotions in the lives of LGBTQ plus Christians, which is shame, humility, pride, and love. And I'm hoping you both can share some sentiments that you heard over and over from people you interviewed, like some common themes. What are some of the main struggles or some of the main things that are bringing them together?
One thing that started to become clear pretty early on was that an LGBTQ plus person had to constantly be displaying shame in order to be welcome in the group. And so we spent a lot of time looking at what is shame? It like came up all the time. People were really trying to figure out how to navigate it. And scholars across a whole lot of disciplines, you know, philosophy, psychology, sociology, theology, right? They all come down to the idea of shame being a fear of being unworthy of relationships. And so if you're having to constantly demonstrate to the people who matter most to you that you know you're unworthy of relationships in order for them to be willing to have a relationship with you and not just throw you out, then you're in this very difficult position where you're having to like just constantly be like, I feel like they love me, but they don't love me. And I love them, but they don't want me too close to them because they think my capacity to love is dangerous to the people that I love. And, you know, like a number of people were told, you know, you can't be around kids, or you can't lead worship, or you can't help people with the dance ministry or whatever it is, because your sin could infect them, right? Or your sin could lead them to a place of doubt, and we can't have that. And that, you know, like constantly being told your capacity to love other people is dangerous. It just really led to a lot of the psychological distress and, you know, feeling like life was not livable for a lot of people.
Before we continue, I'm just going to take a moment to reintroduce you both. If you're just joining us on Like Effect, I'm Audrey Nowakowski speaking with Dawn Moon and Teresa Tobin, authors of Choosing Love. Their book explores how people can identify as both LGBTQ+ and conservative Christians. So one of the ways you examined how people came out of the other side of this sacramental shame that we were just talking about is through the unique lens of pride. So can you explain to me what you guys are looking at when it comes to pride in this community that's different from a typical Christian
lens? Yeah, I'll start with this one. And I can't talk about pride without talking about humility in this context. So I think for one of the things that's really important about what we learned was the connection between humility and pride. So a lot of the folks we talked to were taught from very, very early on that pride is a sin and that it's one of the deadliest sins, maybe the root of all sin, because they equate pride with arrogance, with sort of elevating yourself above God. And so pride was and is, and a lot of people talked about pride being something that could never be explored, let alone felt. So what we learned from folks was, for many, many people, the first step to healing seems to come through a kind of humility, which is an openness to prioritize what we can learn from our relationships to rethink ourselves and rethink what we know, or at least ask questions about it. And that led many people to experience a kind of a sense of their own fundamental goodness and worthiness. And that's the kind of pride we're talking about. So pride, relational pride, is a kind of confidence and joy in your basic human worthiness, that you're just worthy for love and relationship. It's not elevating you above anyone. It's just a basic sense of your own worthiness. And it's a kind of, it's an emotion that I think a lot of people whose dignity isn't regularly called into question, whose existence isn't regularly called into question, take for granted. But for people who are routinely diminished, to be able to feel your own worthiness and to feel joy in that is pride. That's what people were experiencing, that sense of like, wait a minute, I'm worthy of love and connection, period. It's my birthright too.
As authors diving into this topic, who do you feel is the audience for this book, or who do you ideally want to reach?
You know, that's a question that we thought about a lot, particularly with our editor. And I mean, on the one hand, there's an audience of people who have been in this situation, right? Who have been, you know, part of these movements, or who, you know, like people who now characterize themselves as ex-evangelical, who feel like they're survivors of some of the more toxic practices that they've experienced in evangelical churches. And finding words for the experiences that they've had has been really helpful for a lot of people. So that's great. But not being a religious person myself, I really hope that people like me will want to read it too. Like, you know, I'm queer. I left the church as soon as I could, basically. And what I learned from this movement is not just about like how to be a better Christian, right? It's about like the things that are really easy for me as an outsider to see as toxic dynamics are also toxic dynamics that exist within the left. And I hope that more than just the people that the book is specifically about will want to read it, because I think that they, you know, like, I mean, this is a group of people who practice saying things really well, who think really deeply about big questions, and who, you know, work to, you know, put their ideas and their love into bringing other people along on the path. And that path is sometimes liberating and life affirming. And you don't have to convert religions to learn from them.
And for you, Teresa?
Yeah, I would agree with everything that Dawn shared. I have similar feelings about who I hope will read this. I think one of the most powerful messages that kind of goes beyond the narrow group that we learned from and heard from is, what does it mean for love to be politically and morally motivating? When we say we want to love people that are not in our families or our friends, like, what does that mean? What does that look like? How can I engage in a love ethic and a love politics that's really aimed at justice? Like, what's the relationship between those two? So anyone who cares about that question, I think, can learn something from the book, can learn something from their stories, because they're trying to enact that and are having some success. And so that's not a new theme. That's a theme that activists and thinkers have talked about for a long time, but it's a contemporary iteration and practical movement of people trying to enact that. And they have some unique insight given their vantage point and their perspective and their place in contemporary American politics and society.
Well, Dawn and Teresa, I want to thank you both so much for joining me today to talk more about Choosing Love.
Thank you so much for having us. This has been a delight.
Dawn Moon is the Director of Interdisciplinary Gender and Sexuality Studies at Marquette University. Teresa Tobin is an Associate Professor of Philosophy at Marquette. Together, they're the co-authors of Choosing Love, What LGBTQ+ Christians Can Teach Us All About Relationships, Inclusion, and Justice. They spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski.
This is Capital Notes from Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Ayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross. He's editor of WizPolitics.com. Hi, J.R., thanks for joining me.
No, thanks for having me.
All right, we're doing a budget or bust version of Capital Notes today. Monday, June 30th is the deadline for the next 2 year, which is 2025 through 2027 state budget. It provides much of the funding for all state agencies, like the University of Wisconsin System, the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Children and Families. With lawmakers going right to the wire, what have been the biggest areas of contention between Democratic Governor Tony Evers' original budget proposal and the version legislators are considering?
Oh, numerous, but the key here right now is whether they strike a deal on several key areas, one of them being childcare. The governor has kind of put a red line there that he has to see something from the budget that will help families afford childcare. Two, education. He wants more money, especially for special education reimbursement. We're watching that. And then third, Universities of Wisconsin. There had been an idea floated by Republicans of cutting the UW by about $87 million. The governor said that was a non-starter. So he's been working, his office has been working with lawmakers to try and reach some kind of a deal. And those seem to be some of the big parameters of that quote-unquote deal they're working on. The rest of the budget, I mean, they don't have a lot of agreement on much anything. But if they can get those key areas done, then maybe you get a budget that gets through both House and legislature and gets the governor's signature.
Okay, so you mentioned childcare, a significant piece of the budget pie. Specifically, there's this Childcare Counts program. It's a state-run program that supports childcare providers that was funded through federal funds and would end in July without state money. What is Child Care Counts, and how do you think legislators and Governor Evers could strike a deal on it?
Well, that's a good question, because it's basically a subsidy program to providers to help them, you know, boost wages and those kinds of things. And Republicans haven't shown an interest in that program continuing, so the question is, what will they come up with that could be an acceptable alternative to Governor Evers? You know, they don't like the idea of kind of a straight subsidy for childcare, but you know, the final deal, are they won over by the governor's arguments? Do they find some alternative? You know, it's to be determined. They were meeting pretty much all day on Friday, much of Thursday, trying to work out final details. They budget committee worked until late Friday night, but they have work stuff to do, and there's some big things hanging out there, and that's one of them.
And if the legislature doesn't pass a budget by Monday to go into effect Tuesday, July 1st, the state agencies will be operating with the same number of dollars that was decided in 2023. What would you foresee at that point? Like, what could the negotiations look like after that?
Well, I mean, honestly, like, we're not in the federal government where things shut down if you don't pass a budget on time. And so nothing would really change in the near term. It used to be way back when there were pressure points with the budget that, you know, come fall, for example, schools want to know how much they were going to get for an increase per pupil, what they could spend. But that's now kind of in law because the governor uses veto authority 2 years ago to create an annual increase for four centuries of $325 per kid to what they can spend through state aid and property taxes. Now, we don't know how much the state's going to put in for the aid part of that formula, but they know at least how much they can spend in general. Local governments used to always kind of start getting antsy in the fall because they want to know what they were going to get for state aid through shared revenue to help pay for their costs. But now we have a program where that's tied to sales tax collections. They kind of know already what they're going to get. So those things, there's nothing really in the near term they have to do for state, government, or local to operate. However, they want to get this done because it's kind of a symbolic thing to have it done around this time of year. The Republicans want to prove they can govern and get things done. If it were to drag on for months and months and months, then you start to get some problems. For example, Medicaid, that program, it would cost about $1.6 billion more in state money to cover the Medicaid program as it is right now without any changes, just the cost to continue it. Well, at some point, you run out of money to pay your bills in that program because it's going to cost so much more. So, but that's, you know, we're talking a year, year and a half at least before we run into problems. So they've got plenty of time. Still, they want to get it done this week because it's symbolic. It's, you know, get it done by July 4th, go off the rest of the summer and kind of get out of the Capitol.
And so do you have any insights on what might bridge the gap between legislators and Evers on things like childcare and the UW system and things like that?
There were some hints that there some ideas floated last week to give UW a small increase, but to pair it with quote unquote reforms. Now, those weren't defined. And, you know, this I don't have hard, solid answers because they were negotiating. These things were being negotiated still. So they don't have in black and white, this is what we're going to do in UW. These are not shared publicly, but there's an idea out there floated of giving UW a small increase, pairing it with these, you know, to be determined reforms that would make Republicans happy. Childcare, we're still trying to figure out what that looks like. You know, special education, the budget committee has already approved increasing the reimbursement rate to about 37.5%. We're around 32% right now. There's some talk of going higher than that, but we don't have final answers. They're still working through the process, trying to get a deal done on the governor's desk.
And one of the interesting things is right now it's in the Joint Finance Committee. That's the powerful Republican-controlled legislative committee that basically drafts its version of the budget. But then the budget, that budget has to be passed by the Assembly and the Senate. What do Republicans need to do in terms of negotiating with Democrats in the legislature to get that moving?
Well, the first thing is Republicans would love to get a budget done without any Democratic votes. Whenever you're the majority party in a chamber, you want to do things with your own caucus, not rely on the minority party. When you do have to rely on the minority party, you empower them to ask for things. So their first goal is 17 GOP votes in the Senate and 50 in the Assembly. That
remind,
looks unlikely,
remind
however.
People how many, what the balance is right now of power?
Yeah, it's 18-15 for Republicans in the Senate and 54-45 in the Assembly. The problem for Assembly Leader Devin Lemieux is in the Senate, he's already got two members who are all but no. Chris Campia, for example, a Republican from Delafield, he laid out three scenarios, and his preference was to kind of keep the budget as is. Don't do a new budget. Don't pass anything that would allow Evers to use his partial veto authority. So there's that. Steve Nass put out four benchmarks. That includes, for example, a $3.5 billion rebate not a tax cut in terms like ongoing, but a one-time rebate to families. Some other things, he wants a cross-the-board cut in state agencies. Well, Evers is not going to sign that, so those guys are considered no's. So you're down to 16 Republicans in a best-case scenario. The question is, do you have 16 Republicans for sure with whatever you negotiate with Evers? Because the more things you do to make the governor happy, the more you risk alienating Republicans in your caucus and losing members who could be no votes. And the question becomes, how many Democrats would you need to pass that budget? So that's where they're kind of stuck right now, trying to figure out that math and what they have. And, you know, for Democratic lawmakers, I mean, yeah, the governor may negotiate a deal, but if they don't like it, if they don't think it's enough, will they go on board, hold their nose, and vote for it to deliver a budget for the state, or say we need to do something different? So that's kind of still a little bit of the dilemma they have to figure out the final numbers and pass this thing.
You're tuned into Capital Notes. I'm WUWM's Mayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WizPolitics.com. Okay, so a little bit ago, you mentioned Medicaid and how in order to fund it fully, there would need to be a significant increase, $1.6 billion more. How are the potential federal cuts to programs like Medicaid affecting how Wisconsin legislators are writing the state budget?
Oh, great question. We might not know for sure until the state budget is actually done, because this reconciliation package is still working its way through the U.S. Senate right now. They're making changes as we speak. We will see what the final package looks like. But, you know, there's one thought that, you know, you should maybe hold back some money from the surplus just in case. Governor Evers actually proposed doing that in his budget when he put it out back in February, of keeping a bigger reserve just to be on the safe side. Because along with Medicaid, there's programs like food stamps that they're talking about making states pick up more of the cost. So there's some things that if they don't accommodate those or account for them in the budget they pass, lawmakers could be looking at a challenging situation 6-9 months from now.
And in a few of the developments this past weekend, or at least last week, there was this Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program. It's a bipartisan land purchase program that allows Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources to borrow money to buy land and set it aside for conservation programs. Was there any movement on that in the budget negotiations so far, or drafting?
The motion that Republicans approved on Friday for the Department of Natural Resources did not include any money for that program or any extending the authorization. No, it is approved right now through June 30th of 2026. Tony Kurtz, a member of the Finance Committee, Republican from Wanawak, he said, hey, we are working on a separate bill that would extend the authorization for this program. So, you know, it's not in the budget. We're still working on, essentially.
Can you just fill in for people who don't understand, if it's not in the budget right now, how does it get into the budget? Like, until what point can legislators amend things and rework things? And then just like a little bit of basics.
Sure. Like with Knowles-Nelson, they can pass a separate bill. They can do that anytime they want to. So there's no requirement that's done the budget. It's like a tax cut. You could pass a tax cut, standalone bill, anytime you want to. But usually they try and put most of that stuff together in the budget, because it's a balancing act of spending, tax cuts, et cetera, to make sure everything kind of fits. So, you know, there is plenty of time to get something done on the stewardship program. It's just for some Democrats, they like to see it in the budget for more, be more assured that's actually going to get done, because they're just not sure Republicans have the votes to pass that bill, and they're skeptical they can actually get it done with where that caucus is right now.
I see. And on that note, a few weeks ago, Joint Finance had signed off on a $1.3 billion tax cut plan. What's the latest there?
It's still in the budget, as far as we know. We're watching for any tweaks with those conversations with Governor Evers to see if he demands changes. You know, if the governor, I mean, if he's going to run again in 2026, it's not a bad thing to sign a tax cut before you run for election. So it's not geared toward the wealthy. There was a Fiscal Bureau memo that came out that's a nonpartisan budget arm legislature that did analysis of the overall impact of the tax package Republicans approved. The bulk of that, the biggest benefits are those making between $100,000 and $200,000 for adjusted gross income for married couples. Now, definitely upper middle class, but not for the wealthy. So we'll see if Evers is okay with that package or demands some changes or wants other things. Remember, he had a totally different approach to taxes, but that's part of the give and take, right? If he gets what he wants, education and childcare, he then has to give something to make it a true deal, and the tax package may be it.
Interesting. Okay. Also, this two-year budget is kind of still dealing with the ghosts of the 2023-2025 budget, which funded kids' literacy programs. It set aside $50 million to go into a supplemental fund that the Joint Finance Committee asked to release to the Department of Public Instruction. Evers partially vetoed that back in 2023 budget, changing it from funding a literacy coaching program to a literacy program. Why did Evers do that, and what did the Wisconsin Supreme Court say about it?
Oh, he wanted to kind of have a little more authority over how this money is spent, more freedom for Department of Public Instruction. The Supreme Court last week ruled 7-0 that Evers had exceeded his authority. Governors can only veto a bill if it has an appropriation that's actually spending money. The bill that he and the Republicans took this package and put into three different bills. The money was in the budget set aside in the Joint Finance Committee's supplemental appropriation. There was one bill that had some policy and one bill that directed how the money would be spent. Didn't actually spend anything, but laid out how it would be spent. That's the one that Governor Evers used a partial veto authority on. The Supreme Court said, look, you have to have an appropriation, which is setting aside public money for a public purpose. That bill didn't do it, ergo the veto was inappropriate. So it basically restored the bill to as it was if the governor acted. The Finance Committee then released $9 million on Friday of the $50 million roughly that DPI had been set aside for the agency. Now, there was a hint during the meeting on Friday of more is going to come, because if that money is not released by the end of the 30th, Monday, it would lapse back to general fund. But that's kind of an accounting thing. If you put an appropriation in the 25-27 budget, DPS will get that money, you'll be fine. So we're watching the next step. They released a little bit of money right now. There'll be more of it released in the coming weeks. We'll see in this budget and how it works that way.
All right. Thanks for this breakdown, JR. And thanks for joining me on Capital Notes.
Anytime.
You can hear Capital Notes every other Monday on Lake Effect and Morning Edition. You can also find it as a podcast wherever you like to listen. And just like Capital Notes, Lake Effect is a podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. If you can't go to a bar without picking up some pull tabs, you'll want to stick around. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about the history of pull tabs and what makes them so unique. But first, we'll meet the director of Milwaukee Recreation. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Earlier this year, Milwaukee Public Schools approved Brian Litze as the new senior director of Milwaukee Recreation. Milwaukee Rec runs hundreds of programs in the city, from after-school care to youth sports and cooking classes. Litze has been with Milwaukee Rec since 2002 and has worked in various leadership roles in the department over the years. Lake Effect's Excrit Nunez speaks with Litze about his goals and priorities in this role. He begins with why he decided to take the job.
I took it on because I felt like I was ready and I felt like I can serve the community and I felt like I can give my absolute all to the people of Milwaukee, Milwaukee Public Schools, and all the neighborhoods adjoining Milwaukee. I think I've been prepared for this for 23 years of working for Milwaukee Recreation. So it's given me a unique vantage point of the city, the inner workings of recreation, MPS, and I just think of the connections that I've made, and I want to make those collaborations even stronger because my goal and our goal of our department is to have healthy neighborhoods one at a time. A healthy Milwaukee is a healthy environment for all of us, for our schools, for our county. I just wanted to be a part of that so bad.
And as you mentioned, you began your career with Milwaukee Recreation in 2002.
Correct.
How did you first get interested and involved in public recreation?
Sure. Yeah, good question. I've been in college for a long time. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but one of my counselors just said, hey, what do you want to do? And I was like, I love sports. That's all I've been doing all my life as a kid and things like that. And they were like, you want to be a PE teacher? I was like, I don't know about that. How about recreation? And I took my first rec class and I was hooked. I didn't know you could do that. And I didn't know what that experience was like. But once I started taking classes, I was like, I found my place, my village, I think.
Wow. And can you tell me a little bit about the positions that you've had during your time at Milwaukee Rec?
Sure. I started off as a what we used to call assistant supervisor for after-school programs. So I worked in our community learning centers, better known as COCs. So for years, I was assistant supervisor, moved my way up to supervisor, then a manager, and then a coordinator. So at some point, I oversaw all of the after-school programs within Milwaukee Public School. So that was over 80 or 90 programs at one time. So it gave, again, those experience. And after-school space for me at that time when I was doing that, it made me feel like I would hear parents say, we couldn't work without this program. And having our kids somewhere safe and where they have good adults and loving adults in front of them makes them go to work, you know, just feel good about being able to do that and come and get their kids. And sometimes kids don't want to go home because they're having so much fun. And that was like my first 10 years or 11 years of my career. And then after that, I moved up to manager of operations, assistant director, where I focused more on the operations, right? So making sure that we were funded well enough to do these programs. And then I started really working with my former director, Lynn Greb, with our revitalization program of our 52 playfields, which has been a huge success, right? I think Lynn and I both have the philosophy of that recreation is a right. Like, people should have good, clean spaces to recreate and be outside and have all those amenities that other places have. So we devised a plan based on equity, and we put together teams to do this. And we have about 12 or 13 that we've done. And the plan is to have all of them done at some point. You know, I may not be here to see it, but the work will live on because we've done some great planning. And just to see neighborhoods revitalized, not just the space, but neighborhoods because of what's been done there, It's great. And that's why I kind of came up with the theme of like one neighborhood at a time, right? Like until we get a total, you know, healthy Milwaukee. And I've loved it because I've got a chance to work with the city, county partners and partners in our neighborhood. And it's just been a great experience over those now 23 years to work in all those different areas.
What is it about Milwaukee Recreation that's made you want to stick around for so long?
Sure. It's been great because I'm not a native Milwaukee, and I'm from Chicago originally, and I lived in Chicago mostly all my life, except for, you know, college stints. And it was just the people. The job is great. I love what I do. But it's the people that I work with, my colleagues, and the people that I've met in the community, the kids, adults, and everybody that I've had a chance to interact with over my years has just made me love it, right? I heard stories when I first moved here as a 29, 30-year-old person, you know, of how much recreation played a part in the lives of Milwaukeeans, right? Like the playgrounds and the memories that they had. And then as I came up in the apartment, I would see kids that were in our after-school programs years later, and they wouldn't talk about their math class or anything like that. They would talk about the experiences when we took them somewhere or when they had a chance to do something. So making those lasting memories has been, for me, like one of the best things I can ever do in my life as part of this position or job, per se.
That's amazing. So like you mentioned, there are so many aspects of Milwaukee Recreation that your career has touched on. On top of the hundreds of educational and recreational programs Milwaukee Rec offers, the department also oversees the 52 playfields, youth sports, the playfield renovation project. How are you approaching the first few months of this new role?
A little different because, right, I've been embedded in Milwaukee, so I'm not coming in fresh, right? I have a different set of eyes than the former director, Lynn Greb, of course. But my thing is that I've come into it making some challenges to myself and to my team. And one of those challenges is that, you know, we love our social media presence, right? Like we've grown so much with that. But what I really want our team to do and myself to do is get back out into community and meet people face to face, make those partnerships with our neighborhood associations, with our faith-based communities, really walk the neighborhoods to see what the kids and the families are doing and make those real deep-rooted connections with a handshake and a smile.
And so on top of that, are there any like major projects or goals you're looking forward to accomplishing?
Yeah, definitely our play fields, you know, definitely we want to keep doing that. We also have a community center that we're working on, and hopefully that will be 2027, I believe, that'll be up. And I think that'll be a great boost to the community on 76 in Silver Spring. So it'll be the first one that we've ever had where we took the existing school building that was no longer being used, and we're making it into a full-scale community center with a pool, gym, meeting spaces, and things like that. So that'll be a huge challenge for our team. And I want us to be innovative, right? I want us to think about new and vibrant programs and ideas that we can offer to the community, and with the help of the community to kind of let us know where we're missing and what things we can be doing that are new and fresh for them. So that's another challenge that I have for myself and my team.
You know, as we've talked about, Milwaukee has several neighborhoods with their own unique needs and values. How will you make sure to continue connecting and serving so many different communities?
Yeah, I think, again, you know, we have to have a presence, right? We have to show our faces, right? When you see that blue shirt, whether that's a part-time person or that's a full-time person, we have to be approachable and we have to be able to approach the community, right? Like, so welcoming, you know, events and things like that to welcome, you know, the neighborhood to show like, hey, these spaces are yours, right? They don't belong to us per se. They're yours. And just keep making those connections day by day, right? It doesn't happen overnight. And people have to trust you, right? There's, you know, different neighborhoods have their own different cultures and things like that. But I think we have to be embedded in those cultures as well to have the neighborhood trust. And along with, I mean, we can't do it by ourselves. So I love working with our, you know, local aldermen, local county supervisors, local school officials and things like that. So I think it's a group effort. And that's how I hope, you know, we can kind of take one neighborhood at a time and build those real lasting relationships.
Right. Well, before we wrap up, I want to ask you, how do you envision the future of Milwaukee Recreation?
The future of Milwaukee Recreation. I envision it as strong and vibrant, having collaborations and input from our neighborhoods and our community leaders and anybody in the community that uses our facilities and wants to use our facilities, have a say in what's going on in their play field or in their community center. And we have open and vibrant spaces for everybody to use, and it's safe. Again, healthy neighborhoods means healthy schools, means healthy environment, you know, ecosystem. It all kind of trickles down. And that's how I see Milwaukee Rec playing its part in the whole system of Milwaukee.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really appreciate your time, and I'm excited to see Milwaukee Rec out there.
Again, we can't thank you enough. And anytime you want to have us and talk about programs or anything else, please let us know. We'll be here.
Brian Litzy is Milwaukee Recreation's director, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez shortly after taking on the role earlier this year. He's the department's 11th director in its 114-year history. We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk going, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll learn about pull tabs, a staple of tavern culture in Wisconsin. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. If you've ever been to a corner bar in Wisconsin, chances are you've seen a pull tab machine. They're a staple of tavern culture in the state, a form of light gambling that brings together families and friends while they share a pitcher and complain about the brewers. T. Krulos explores the history and legality of pull tabs in an article for Milwaukee Magazine. He joins me to talk about the culture of pull tabs. If you had just moved to Milwaukee, you've never seen one of these machines before, how would you describe it?
A pull tab machine. They're found in a lot of bars across the state. And you put a buck into it, or $5, and then you get a game piece. And you flip it over, and there's these strips on the back. And it's a very satisfying feeling of pulling those strips, kind of unzip them, and you see if you want a prize. And it's not going to be a big prize, like you're not going to be able to retire from your day job, but they typically pay out a few dollars. The maximum you can win on one is $250. So it's this kind of a fun thing that friends like to do at a bar. You get a bunch of pull tabs. You sit there unzipping them, seeing if anyone won. And a lot of times that money is just put into buying more beer or buying more pull tabs so you can keep playing.
Full disclosure, I would say about a month back, I had friends who were in town, one of whom is a Wisconsinite, loves pull tabs, and I did win. A dollar.
A dollar. I was going to say,
pull tabs.
The most I've won is $2. So.
Yeah. which seems pretty standard. But one of the things that your article got into right away, which I have never really thought about before, is why are they legal? Like, for whatever reason, this had never occurred to me. But yeah, it is odd that they are legal.
Yeah, that's what started the whole story. My editor just wanted me to find out the answer to that question. And I found that the story behind it is pretty complicated, actually. It goes back to the late 90s. There was a guy named Walter Borer who was in the business of what they call coin-operated amusement machines. So he provided pinball and jukeboxes, stuff like that. And as sort of his retirement plan, he came up with Wisconsin Souvenir Melcaps, which is the pull tab company. And he created this by very seriously studying Wisconsin Statute 100.16. there are exceptions to gambling in that. You can create a sweepstakes, right? So it is actually a sweepstakes. You can write to the company and they will mail you a game piece. But of course, most people prefer to play it at a bar while they're enjoying a beer. The other thing is, if you can attach your thing to something of value, and this is why if you've ever played like McDonald's, Monopoly, that's legal, is because you get some French fries along with your game piece. So Walter thought about this, and his argument is that on the front of the pull tab, there's a circular design, and that design can be cut out and saved as a collectible POG. So that is sort of the loophole, if that's what you want to call it, is that you're actually paying for this collectible POG, not the game piece on the back necessarily. So he had to go to court because in the late 90s, he was raided. They confiscated his pull tabs. And he was like, no, you don't, because I actually put a lot of thought into this. So he went to court and they admitted that, you know, he was in the right and that what he was doing is legal. The Wisconsin Department of Revenue is a little skeptical of this.
Sure.
From talking to them. And they're like, come on, really a POG? But I don't know. I don't think it's a bad argument. I mean, I don't think there's a lot of POG collectors out there, but people collect vinyl and VHS tapes, and I'm
people
sure there's
collect
POG collectors
all
out there,
kinds
too.
Of things. I used to and still have a small collection of potato chip bags.
Okay. See? Yeah. People love to
weird
collect
things.
different things.
Now, it does seem like there was a bit of fancy footwork in order to make them legal using this kind of idea of, well, you know, the POG, that's really this, this is what people are buying. But as you say, it was fought out in courts. Pull tabs won, ostensibly. Now, are all pull tab machines today, are they all legal or?
No, I mean, according to what I found, Wisconsin Souvenir Melcaps are the ones that are operating legally because they do follow those guidelines from Statute 100.16. So other pull tabs that you see out there are probably not legal because, you know, they don't have that collectible feature. You also have to keep records of certain winnings. You have to clearly state the odds on your game piece. There's a lot of like little details that you have to follow. And some of those other companies are just kind of making like knockoff pull tabs, I guess I would call them.
Hmm. It's interesting to think about them in that context, just because they're such a Wisconsin thing. I think they're also popular in some other Midwestern states like Minnesota, yeah. for example.
Yeah.
But they are such a kind of cultural touch point. What do you think makes them so popular among people?
I mean, I think it works so well in Wisconsin just because the tavern culture here is so strong. It's most people spend some time hanging out in the bar. And this is something that kind of keep your hands busy, something social you can do with another person. There is that thrill, you know, even when I won $2, I was like, hey, I'm a winner. I won $2, you know. But like you say, they're very popular here. They're even more popular in our neighbor. Minnesota is the biggest state for pull tabs. And they do exist in other states. They usually have a different name. That's more of like a localized thing. But yeah, it's a big part of the tavern culture here in general.
Well, T, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
T. Krulos is a freelance writer based in Milwaukee. We spoke about pull tabs in 2023. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll explore the history of the earliest Barbie dolls and tell you how Barbie's origin story is connected to Wisconsin. Thanks so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.